Our next speaker is George Paul. He's with the Texas A&M AgriLife Research Institute, and he's going to tell us about time series ET mapping using satellite data. So we'll look at a spatial level.
Thank you, Kendall. Once again, I'll give my introduction. My name is George Paul, and I work as a research scientist with Texas A&M AgriLife Amarillo. And I work out at Bushland, Texas, so it's the outskirts of Amarillo. So I work with a very influential group of people who have all the technology for water research. You name it, and you have those instruments with that group. So it's a privilege to be working out at Bushland with the Bushland group. This is a funded project, and I'll be acknowledging funding agencies. So my objectives all would be the objectives of the project, and the objective of the project is to produce daily evapotranspiration map for a region, for the studied region, which also I'll be shortly showing you. So the title is very simple, mapping evapotranspiration on a spatial scale using satellite data, and basically two satellites, that's Landsat and MODIS. So both the approaches are totally different because Landsat, we have a revisit time of 16 day, and MODIS we can acquire on a daily basis. But then always there's a trade-off between the spatial and temporal resolutions, which is what the spatial modelers or spatial ET remote sensing modelers are trying to fill that gap. Okay, with that brief introduction, again a small introduction why we need spatial ET. I don't think we need to have a long discussion on this. There is a vast demand for a spatial ET, and also on a daily scale. Whether it's agricultural crop water use, crop demand, water allocation, or hydrology, be it surface water, groundwater, drought, you name it, be it in ecology, net ecosystem productivity, species, invasion, or extinction, whatever, you name it, and ET can be used directly or as a decision support tool for coming across. For producing information, for taking a decision. Again, the last but not the least, nowadays it's the carbon water energy nexus that's widely talked about, and the linkage, the close linkage between these three is again an advantage where we can deploy EC systems and capture the fluxes, these three fluxes on any ecosystem, be it grassland, agriculture, mountain, wherever, and study that thing in accordance with the climate change. So again, the project deliverable or the project objective was developing daily time series evapotranspiration map using Landsat TM and the MODIS data. So I'll quickly go into the theory. The remote sensing based techniques basically works on the surface reflectance, but some of them directly try to compute the crop coefficient based on the NDVI, but what we work on a full-fledged energy balance where we compute the latent heat as a residual of the rest of the term. So the net energy balance equation is the first what you see on your right-hand side, and we just compute all the components of the energy balance and compute latent heat as a residual. So this is the SEBS algorithm, which is developed by Bob Su at University of Twente, Netherlands. The upper limit is defined this of sensible heat. The lower limit is defined by Penman-Monteith equation, and the sensible heat is derived from the flux variance derivation, what you see over here. Throughout the session, different presentations, we were hearing about the resistance. So this over here, what you are seeing is a bulk resistance, bulk aerodynamic resistance to heat transfer. So this relationship based on Mobin-Obukhov equation, and like Dr. Kimball was asking, the correction factors used like psi h, the correction for buoyancy, is based on Paulsen in 1970. This is a bulk resistance. So computing this over different landscapes, that's a challenge because of various things. I'm not going into detail, but the complexity is when we divide all these resistances, or when we want to have these resistances as accurate as possible, we'll end up into different problems. So empirism is the easiest way to approach this thing, and that's the only way to approach it. Anyway, so in this model, SEBS, what Bob Sue did was introduce the excess resistance that's the KB inverse that you see over here. So again, not going into too much detail, this is to consider the differences between the aerodynamic temperature and the radiometric temperature. So again, coming into the next model, the two-source model, and of which I'll be showing the results and talking more in detail. And here again, the complexity is more because we try to divide the single bulk sensible heat into three different sensible heats: the total bulk, the soil sensible heat, the canopy sensible heat, and with that comes in more complexity because with each of those sensible heat is attached the resistances for the soil, for the canopy, and the bulk. So all the RX, RS, RA, all the resistance terms, whatever you see over there, I just want to tell that this is computed as from empirical equations derived long term back in the 1970s, 80s, and there is a huge requirement of somebody doing a research on the resistances to come up with a more better empirical equation, but it's not there. Anyway, so the two-source model works basically on this framework with the radiometric temperature divided between the canopy temperature and the soil temperature. That's the first equation that's shown over there. So all these equations are combined to come across the different temperatures. So what we are trying to do in two sources is basically derive somehow the canopy temperature, the soil temperature from one single temperature. And that's the radiometric temperature that we receive from the satellite data. So we are dividing one temperature into two or three, whatever you say. And one more thing quickly I want to touch upon is the Presley-Taylor's equation. That's the last equation over here. So the Presley-Taylor's equation is developed with the Presley-Taylor's coefficient. That's over there, 1.3, which is the upper limit, or you can say that a well-irrigated crop Presley-Taylor's coefficient. But when we are applying on a landscape, we need to somehow consider for the different stress levels that are there in the different crops or different objects on the surface. So what John Norman did, who developed the two-source model, is a smart thing to introduce another coefficient there. That's the fraction of greenness, FG, that you see there. So with that, you can just consider or modulate this whole thing to consider the different stress levels. So if the fraction of greenness is 0.1, you can say that the canopy is drying out. If it's 0.9, you can say the canopy is really green. So with that single coefficient, we are trying to consider the landscape, covering the different landscapes or covering the different levels of stresses over the landscape. Okay. Quickly into our study area. This is our Oklahoma State. This is the study region. We have a very detailed MESONET weather network with a very good density of weather stations. And these are the two Landsat scenes, which is shown over there, and the two sites, intensive field campaign sites, that are shown over there. Okay, and this is for the MODIS. This is two tiles of the MODIS, which we are using develop the daily scale. And again, MODIS we can acquire on a daily time scale, the images. And the resolution for the products range from 500 to 250 meters. So we can even acquire, we have the 250 meters in red and the infrared radiance, which we can utilize to compute NDVI and can come across more refined information. But here we are not using that. We are just using the visible bands at the 500 meter reflectance and the thermal band at 1,000 meter reflectance. So this is the total tile, but our study area is just constrained to Oklahoma, Texas, Panhandle, and the Kansas State. the better the input, the good the output would be. So the saying garbage in, garbage out, we try to put in as good as possible in good inputs into the modeling framework, and then only we can expect the results. So all these variables, the point-based studies, we can use a single point to do that, but with the good network of weather stations, I think we did a good job of developing a framework where we can incorporate the MESONet data and have a spatial surface for all these inputs. Plus, the reference ET and the daily reference ET is also incorporated as a spatially interpolated surface. Okay, some of the things that we have incorporated into the modeling framework is the atmospheric correction. We all know we need to do some kind of atmospheric correction for the satellite data. Again, the spatially interpolated input and new functions for varying the Presley-Taylor coefficient, because like I said, the transpiration or evapotranspiration is considered by the Presley-Taylor's equation. We need to somehow vary it. So we have a function introduced to vary the Presley-Taylor's coefficient fraction of greenness according to the NDVI. And again, the instantaneous ET is extrapolated into the daily time scale using a new scaling algorithm. Basically, it's nothing new over there, but we are using the reference ET or a more known form of upper limit, that's reference ET, to scale down our instantaneous ET into daily. This is an example, just a snapshot of a small region to tell you that how distinctly we can see the different landscape and the different values of ET in that landscape. Very clearly, we can make out the agricultural fields, the grasslands, the drainage pattern, and those are the ET numbers what you see over there. The confidence level we'll discuss later on, but yeah, we can see a clear gradient. I want to prove is, yes, the remote sensing based ET estimates can capture or is capturing the variation in the ET in a good way. Okay, coming to the results, this is the 365 or yearly trend of the ET from remote sensing and the observation tower, basically a EC observation, eddy covariance observation over a grassland in El Reno. And you can see there's nothing to be explained over here, but towards the starting of the year there is a lag or underestimation, and towards the latter part of the year there is a good agreement. So I don't want to speculate on what is the reason. There is a lot of speculations that can be made, whether it's the EC system's response during the starting of the year, or it's the algorithm which is not capturing the ET correctly during this early part of the year. Whatever it is, regression shows that we have a good accuracy. Another site at the same place is a grassland, a burnt grassland, and here again somewhat similar response is during the initial part. There is some lag or there is some underestimation, but towards the latter part of the year there is a good agreement. And again, the 1:1 relationship or a correlation we can see over here, how much is there. Tim was showing the RMSC error here. What we can see is 0.87 mm, where Tim was even showing us 1.1. But whatever, this is there can be a lot of deliberation, what is the right RMSC that we can accept or not. But when we look at the R-square and the Nash-Cutcliffe coefficient, the agreement is good, 0.73, 0.74. It's a good agreement. Okay, this is the yearly for 2 years on a cornfield, E and T separate. So the total, the dark line is the E, and you can see how the transpiration and the evaporation over the year is moving on a cornfield, central pivot. Okay, to summarize, We have a database for this region, that is the Great Plains, portion of the Great Plains with Landsat TM, ET, ENT. And the accuracy of the daily ET, we feel is good. It's good enough for whatever work we plan to do. And MODIS ET is underway. We are working on that. And with that, I want to acknowledge Dr. Jeff Basara, who is maintaining the WeatherNet, MESONet at Oklahoma, Dr. Xiaoming Zhu, and Jin at OU, University of Oklahoma, the funding agency, USD and EFA-AFRI, basically the grazing cap. And thank you.